Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are going
diving deep.
Yes, diving deep into a Supreme Court case that is super relevant to digital privacy.
It really is.
It's Clapper v. Amnesty International USA, decided in 2013. And, you know, it really boils down to one question.
Okay.
Can you challenge government surveillance before it actually, like, happens to you?
That's a great question. And this whole thing revolves around a key legal concept called standing.
Okay, standing.
Yeah. So, like, imagine you want to sue someone for polluting a river.
Okay.
To even, like, get your case heard, you need to show that you've personally been harmed by that pollution.
So you can't just sue because, like, you think pollution is bad. You have to be directly affected.
Exactly. You got to have skin in the game. It's the same with surveillance. To have standing, you need to prove you've been harmed or, like, are about to be harmed to get your foot in the courtroom door.
Okay, that makes sense in, like, a general way. But when we're talking about government surveillance, it's not exactly like you can see or touch the harm.
Right. And that's what makes Clapper so interesting. The plaintiffs in this case were this group of lawyers, journalists, and human rights researchers. And their argument was that the government surveillance program under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act could be used to intercept their conversations.
So, like, they were worried about basically just, like, you know, being listened to.
Yeah, they were worried about a chilling effect on their work.
Chilling effect.
Yeah, like the idea that knowing you might be watched makes you censor yourself or avoid certain topics.
Oh, I get it. So it's like knowing there's a camera pointed at you, even if you're not doing anything wrong, you still act differently.
Exactly. Okay. You got it. Now, the thing is, these plaintiffs couldn't actually prove they were being surveilled, but their argument was that the potential for surveillance was enough to cause harm.
Okay, so let's unpack the two sides, starting with the majority opinion written by Justice Alito. It sounds like they weren't convinced by that argument.
Yeah, you're right on that. The majority basically said, look, your fear of being surveilled is too speculative. It's not, like, concrete enough to give you standing.
But wouldn't that make it almost impossible to challenge any surveillance program?
Well, that's the debate, right? Alito really focused on all the things that would have to happen for the plaintiff's concerns to actually come true.
So, like, what? What would have to happen?
Well, first, the government would have to decide to target their foreign contacts' communications, right?
Okay, makes sense.
Then they would have to choose to use this specific program, Section 702, instead of all the other surveillance methods they have available.
Right. And wasn't this Section 702 part of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act?
Yeah, you got it. That was passed after 9/11 to give the government more tools to, like, track potential terrorists. But it's been controversial because of its potential impact on privacy.
Yeah, definitely. So we're really getting to the heart of that tension between national security and individual privacy.
Exactly. So going back to Alito's logic, the surveillance would have to be successful in actually intercepting the communications. And then on top of that, the plaintiffs themselves would have to be part of those specific conversations being intercepted.
Wow. So, like, a lot of ifs.
A lot of ifs. Exactly. Yeah. Alito was basically saying, look, there are other surveillance methods the FISC might not even approve. The request interception isn't guaranteed. And even if it were, the plaintiffs' particular conversations might not get swept up in the net.
So the majority was basically like, this is way too hypothetical.
Pretty much. Yeah. They saw the plaintiffs' claims as just too speculative to give them standing.
Okay, so round one goes to the government, I guess.
Yep.
But we're just getting started, right? What about the dissenting opinion?
Oh, things are about to get spicy. Justice Breyer brought the heat with his dissent. He argued that the threat from Section 702 was totally real and the plaintiffs' fears were justified.
Okay, so where did Breyer differ from the majority? What was his take?
Well, he saw Section 702 as this, like, broad, programmatic kind of surveillance, not just targeted at specific people like the majority seemed to focus on.
So it's not about whether your phone call is being listened to. It's about the fact that the government has the power to listen to a whole bunch of phone calls, and yours could be in there.
That's it. And to really hit this point home, Breyer focused on the work these plaintiffs did.
Oh, right. Like lawyers and journalists?
Exactly. Lawyers representing people accused of terrorism, human rights researchers digging into, like, sensitive stuff, journalists doing international investigations. They're all talking to people who might be of interest to intelligence agencies.
So if the government is looking for a certain type of information, these are the people who are probably talking about it.
Right. And the dissent used a really powerful example to illustrate this. They talk about Scott McKay, a lawyer who had represented someone whose communications were intercepted.
No way.
We're talking 10,000 calls and 20,000 emails.
Oh, wow. That is creepy.
It really shows the potential scope of this program. And Breyer argued that because of the type of work these plaintiffs did, they basically had a big target on their backs. They're likely talking about stuff the government wants to hear. Plus, he pointed out that the government has done this kind of surveillance before, and they have the technical ability to do it again under Section 702.
So he's saying this is not some far-off possibility. It's happening or could happen very soon.
Exactly. Breyer argued that the threat was certainly impending, which is a key legal term for standing. He thought the majority was setting the bar way too high, basically making it impossible to challenge programs like this.
Okay, so we've got two very different interpretations of the law and the level of risk here.
We do.
What does this all mean for, you know, for us? What are the implications of each side winning this argument?
That's where things get really interesting, because this case goes beyond the legal stuff. It gets at a fundamental question about the balance of power in a democracy. How do we protect ourselves without giving up too much freedom?
That's a tough one.
It is. The majority opinion really leans on the idea that courts shouldn't be meddling with national security, especially when it comes to fighting terrorism.
Right. But like the dissent pointed out, if we make it too hard to even question these surveillance programs, don't we end up giving up some essential freedoms? Like, if you can't even raise a legal challenge until after your privacy's been violated, what's the point?
You got it. That's a really important point. It raises some big questions for all of us. What would you do if you were in the plaintiff's shoes? Knowing this type of surveillance is possible, would it change how you communicate, especially with people overseas?
Honestly, it makes me a little uncomfortable thinking about it.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how much privacy we're actually giving up in the name of security.
It's a valid question, and it's important to remember that this case was decided way back in 2013 before Edward Snowden and all the stuff he revealed about the extent of government surveillance.
Well, yeah.
So if anything, these questions are even more important today.
Absolutely. This case was just one tiny peek into the world of government surveillance. Who knows what other programs are out there that we don't even know about?
That's the question, isn't it?
And what does it all mean for how our digital lives are being tracked and analyzed?
Those are questions we should all be asking ourselves. And this case gives us a starting point for thinking about them.
Well, listeners, I think we've successfully navigated the ins and outs of Clapper v. Amnesty.
We did.
But really, this is just the beginning.
It is.
We encourage you to, like, dig deeper, read more about this case, look into the Snowden leaks, learn about the NSA. We've given you the spark. Now it's your turn to go explore.
That's what we want.
And as you do that, we'll leave you with this. What does this case tell us about how privacy is changing in the digital age?
Ooh, good question.
It's only getting more important, and we'll keep digging into it here on The Deep Dive. Until next time, stay curious.
Okay, but what about the plaintiffs saying they were already being harmed? They said they had to spend all this money on security measures to protect their communications. Wouldn't that be enough to show they were being harmed?
That's a good point, and the majority actually addressed that directly.
Okay.
They said those security measures were basically self-inflicted harm based on fear, not actual surveillance.
Hmm. So, like, you can't just create your own harm to get standing.
Exactly. You can't manufacture standing by spending a bunch of money on precautions just because you're worried about something that hasn't actually happened.
Okay, so round one goes to the government. But let's talk about the dissent. Yeah, things are going to get interesting.
Oh, yeah. Justice Breyer did not hold back in his dissent. He argued that the threat of surveillance under Section 702 was absolutely real, and the plaintiffs were right to be worried.
Okay, so where did Breyer and the majority disagree? Well, a big difference was how they viewed Section 702. Breyer saw it as this, like, broad program allowing for a ton of surveillance, not just targeted surveillance on individuals.
Okay, so it's not just about whether your conversation is being listened to. It's about the fact that they can listen to tons of conversations, and yours might be in there.
Exactly. And he really emphasized the type of work these plaintiffs were doing to make his point.
Like lawyers and journalists and stuff.
Right. These are lawyers representing people accused of terrorism, human rights researchers looking into really sensitive stuff, journalists doing international investigations, They're all talking to people who are likely to be on the government's radar.
So if the government is looking for a certain type of information, these are the people who are going to have it.
Exactly. And the dissent brought up a really powerful example. They talked about this lawyer, Scott McKay, who had a client whose communications were totally intercepted.
Seriously?
Yeah, we're talking 10,000 phone calls and 20,000 emails.
That's wild.
It really shows you the potential scope of this program. So Breyer's point was that because of the kind of work these plaintiffs do, they're basically targets. They're likely talking about things the government wants to hear. Plus, he pointed out that the government has done this type of surveillance before, and they have the ability to do it again.
So you're saying this isn't some theoretical thing. It's already happening, or it could happen any day now.
Right. He argued that the threat was certainly impending, which is a key legal term for proving standing. He thought the majority was making it way too hard to challenge these kinds of programs.
Wow. Okay. So we've got two very different ways of looking at the law and the level of risk involved here. What does it all mean for, you know, regular people like us? What are the implications of each side's argument?
That's what makes this case so fascinating. It goes beyond legal technicalities and gets at a fundamental question about democracy. How do we protect national security without giving up too much freedom?
Yeah, that's a big one.
The majority opinion really relies on the idea that courts shouldn't interfere with intelligence gathering, especially when it comes to fighting terrorism.
But like the dissent pointed out, if it's too hard to even question these programs, aren't we giving up some really important freedoms?
Mm-hmm.
If you can't challenge something until after your privacy has been violated, what's the point of having privacy rights at all?
That's a great point. It raises some serious questions. What would you do if you were one of these plaintiffs? Knowing this kind of surveillance is happening, would you change how you communicate? Especially with people in other countries.
I don't know. It's a little unsettling to think about.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how much privacy we're giving up just so the government can keep tabs on things.
It's a valid concern. And remember, this case was decided back in 2013 before Edward Snowden blew the whistle on all that NSA surveillance stuff.
Oh, right.
So those questions are even more important today.
For sure. This case was just a tiny glimpse into what's really going on with government surveillance. Who knows what other programs are out there?
Right. It's a little scary.
And what does it mean for how our online lives are being tracked and used?
These are questions we should all be thinking about. And this case gives us a framework for having that conversation.
This whole conversation has really got me thinking about my own digital footprint.
Yeah.
What about you? What really stood out to you about this Clapper case?
You know what gets me is what happens after the majority's decision. Like, did this actually make it harder to fight government surveillance?
Yeah.
And I think it probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Because by setting such a high bar for proving harm, it basically tips the scales towards national security, maybe even at the cost of our privacy.
Right. And it puts the courts in a really tough spot, too.
Yeah.
Because you want to give the government the power to protect us from threats, but you don't want to give them a free pass to just ignore our privacy.
It's a tough balance. And that balance gets even trickier as technology keeps advancing.
Right.
I mean, the tools they have for surveillance are getting more and more powerful.
Right.
So the questions raised by this case are becoming even more important.
Totally. It's not just about legal stuff. It's about our everyday lives and how we communicate.
It is.
Knowing that someone could be listening in changes how you interact with people.
Yeah, it really does. And remember, this was all happening back in 2013?
Before Snowden.
Yeah, way before Snowden. So who knows what's going on now?
That's what's kind of scary, right? Like, this case was just a glimpse into a much bigger world of surveillance.
It is.
What other programs are out there? And how is all this data being used?
Those are questions we all need to be asking ourselves.
So what can we do?
Yeah.
It all feels a little overwhelming, to be honest.
Well, knowledge is power, right?
True.
The more we know about how surveillance is being used and how it affects us, the better we can protect ourselves.
Yeah, and we can start talking about these things more.
Exactly. With our friends, our families, even our elected officials. Let's make some noise about this.
I love that. We're not alone in this. There are organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation who are fighting for our digital privacy. There are journalists and researchers who are doing amazing work to expose what's going on.
Exactly.
We can all be part of the solution.
Absolutely.
Well, listeners, I think we've done our best to break down this really complex case. Hopefully you learned something new and maybe even got a little bit of healthy paranoia.
Just a little.
But in all seriousness, stay curious, stay informed, and stay engaged. The future of our privacy might depend on it.
It really might.
Until next time on The Deep Dive.